I'd like to give the first three questions to dissenters. If anybody, everyone was respectful here, so those who want to register a strong disagreement or dissent from what I had to say, I think they should have the right to go first.
So I disagree because I don't think Israel won this war. I don't think it was a victory for Israel. So that's the disagreement. I also think that organization that Mr. Finkelstein talked about lacked among North American academics. From Mr. Chomsky all the way to Judith Butler, all the way down to professors in UBC, they failed to come together. I don't have their emails. You guys share your email list. They failed to come together like the academics in England, who finally, after 3 weeks, were able to put a beautiful letter together with hundreds of signatories. I called ZNET. I called all these institutions. I left messages to all these professors. Why aren't you guys organized? We're ready to organize too, and we're doing our best, but I think we lack that North American academic coming together in a big list, like very basic stuff, and create support. Thank you.
Well, I'm not an academic anymore, thank goodness. I'm not sure if I ever was. I understand that there are people coming together to make a statement on this. Professors are coming together to make a statement on the subject. But, you know, we shouldn't get too carried away with professors. Most of them are windbags. We all know that. I want to be careful. I don't include the natural science, not natural sciences. They're smart. We also know that. I'm talking about those so-called social sciences, which are all stupid, and we all know that. But, you know, it's our responsibility, too. And it's our main responsibility. I don't know how many professors there are in this room, but there are a lot of people in the room. And we have to get organized.
Okay.
I have a feeling this is not the dissent I had in mind, but okay.
I first want to congratulate Dr. Dindeman for his brave stance and for this visit that he made over here to help lift the fog over the eyes of many people about the misconception about the Palestinian cause and the reality of the Israeli government. But there's some quick points, sir, that regarding the main goal of why Israel went to Gaza, I agree 100% about the two things that you mentioned, but I do believe, as a Muslim Arab from Egypt, that the main goal for Israel to enter Gaza was to crush an Islamic government, because this war is a continuation of the war on terror, which George W. Bush actually called for in 2001, and the state of Israel is rallying and is known to be an ally to the U.S. government. So basically, the second point that I want to make here also very quick is that there's the reason why there's a war on an Islamic government is because the world's now becoming to understand really what Islam is all about. The world is turning to Islam. The world's finding out that Islam is a peaceful religion and it has a solution to the world's problem. And that's what makes Israel and America in fear, because Islam stands against tyranny, against treachery, against robbing people out of their own resources, against turning them into slaves to hold a bank, and so on and so forth. And that's the biggest fear to this government. Thank you very much.
The problem is, there's just no evidence to support that claim. It's useful because of The problem is, there's no evidence to support that claim. But allow me to finish, please. Probably the most insightful speeches that were delivered during the massacre in Gaza were the ones on a nightly basis by the Secretary General of the Hezbollah, Nasrallah. He was giving nightly speeches to commemorate Ashura. And it's worth it. It's worth everybody's time, I think, to listen to what he had to say. And he was very emphatic day in and day out on two points. He said, number one, This is not an Israeli war, he said. It's an American war. It's all about the American goal of trying to dominate the Middle East. And number two, he kept saying, it has nothing whatsoever to do with Islam. The U.S. doesn't care if you're Islamic, Christian, Buddhist, atheist, whateverist. They only care about one thing, whether you're willing to follow orders. If you're willing to follow orders, they like you, and if you're unwilling, they don't like you. That's the only criterion. Let's look at another example. They claim Ahmadinejad. He's so terrible. He's a Holocaust denier. What could be worse than that? Well, there happens to be another very famous Holocaust denier in the Middle East. This person actually wrote his doctoral dissertation denying the Nazi Holocaust. This person then was so pleased with his doctoral dissertation denying the Holocaust, he self-published it in Lebanon. And who is this person? His name is Dr. Mahmoud Abbas. Yes, America's favorite, the head of the so-called Palestinian so-called authority. He's also a great intellectual. He got his doctorate denying the Nazi Holocaust. Does Israel care? Does the United States care? Of course not. Some of you don't understand why, because you haven't seen The Wizard of Oz. If you've seen The Wizard of Oz, you'll know that there are good witches and bad witches. The good witch is the beautiful Glinda. And the bad witch, I forget her name all the time. And it's the same thing with Holocaust deniers. There are good Holocaust deniers like Mr. Abbas or Dr. Abbas. And there are bad ones like Mr. Ahmadinejad. That's the same. There are good Muslims like the heads of Saudi Arabia. They're good Muslims. And then there are bad Muslims. There are bad Muslims like Mr. Nasrallah. He's an evil Muslim because he has this weird idea that it's the Arab people and Muslim people who should control the destiny of the Muslim and Arab world. A very weird idea. He's obviously evil.
Hello, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Finkelstein, for your insightful talk. I'm a dissenter, but a dissenter against the Canadian government and media, not against what you've been saying. So I don't know if that counts, but I'm glad you brought up the Canadian media. My name's Gordon Murray. I'm one of the creators of a parody edition of the Vancouver Sun, which satirized its pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinian bias. We put it out a year and a half ago, and we're now being sued by CanWest, which is Canada's largest media conglomerate, for putting out this parody. So I'm really interested in your comments on the media. I just wanted to tell people that if they want to find out more about this case, which is a significant attack on freedom of expression for all Canadians, that they can go to the seriouslyfreespeech.ca website, and we have a forum coming up in February 17th at Harbour Centre. There's flyers for it outside. So that's the end of the ad. I just wanted to ask you, Dr. Finkelstein, as far as strategies in dealing with the media, here in Canada, as you pointed out, it's horrific. The Vancouver Sun, on the day after Israel shelled the two UN schools and killed 42 civilians, the Vancouver Sun carried the story on page B6 with no header anywhere else in the paper, and the headline was, "Pressure Grows for Ceasefire." That's how they. That's what we're up against in terms of public education in Canada, getting the word out about what's actually happening. So I appreciate your recommendation that people organize and tell the truth. But I wonder if you have any specific recommendations on how to deal with the media beyond doing parody editions as we did, or writing letters to the editor, which there is very little effect. And I was wondering if you have an idea or a personal opinion on how the media works. Is it an elite consensus that keeps the news so homogenized, or what kind of strategies are at play there?
I don't believe that any longer the mainstream media pose a major obstacle to us knowing the truth. There was a time when it was very difficult to find things out if the major media effectively colluded to obscure or falsify the truth. But nowadays, it just doesn't seem that people are any longer so dependent on the Globe and Mail, the New York Times, and those other forms of those other mainstream media. I follow these topics quite closely, and it's very striking to me. I probably get in any given day between 100 and 300 emails just of people sending me information. And it's very striking how little articles from the Times, the Globe and Mail, and so forth actually are circulated among people on the web. That's one of the reasons why, you know, the Times is in serious financial help. And speaking as a resolute atheist, with God's help, hopefully it will go broke. I think that people have now managed to find ways to keep themselves reasonably well informed about what's going on. What the media is doing is shameful, that's for sure. It's wretched beyond words, that's for sure. But I don't think it any longer poses an insurmountable obstacle to knowing the truth. So I'm not so concerned about it anymore. Of course, you would like them to acknowledge what's happening, but if they want to go their merry way, let them, because they're becoming, I think, in many respects, largely irrelevant.
You say you want a two-state solution based around the 67 borders and a just resolution to the refugee issue based on the right of return. Would you not agree that such an influx of Palestinian refugees into Israel would eventually, if not immediately, eliminate Israel's Jewish majority and therefore destroy Israel's fundamental reason for existing in the first place? And if you do agree with that statement, would not such a resolution be inherently unviable?
Okay. I take it that's a dissenting question, and I'm glad. I'm glad. You know, we should hear it, we should discuss it, and we should test my ability not just to advocate reasonableness, but also test my ability to be reasonable. So I'm going to try to give you a systematic and comprehensive response. And I'll acknowledge to begin with, it takes courage for you to ask that question in what's obviously a hostile audience, and I acknowledge that. I mean, you're showing more courage here than the IDF showed in Gaza, but that's a separate question. Okay, so let me begin. Number one, not to split semantical hairs, but I didn't advocate anything. I want to be clear on that. What I did was tell you what the record of the international community is. I said every year the highest political body in the world, the UN General Assembly, the most representative political body in the world votes for the two-state settlement, the resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. Every year, the whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, some South Sea islands on the other side. The highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, it says Israel has no right to any of the West Bank and Jerusalem, West Bank and Gaza. It says Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. It says the settlements are illegal under international law. On the question of the refugees, the most respected human rights organizations in the world, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Now, bear in mind, as I make plain in my remarks, I don't personally have much regard for them. But if you were to ask a general audience what are the most respected human rights organizations in the world, most would say Amnesty and HRW, Human Rights Watch. Now, both organizations in 2000 and 2001 published official position papers on the right of return. And both of these organizations stated that there can be no question that the Palestinian refugees and successive generations who have maintained genuine links with the land have the right of return. That's their position. So it's not me that's saying it. It is what I take to be, and I think a fair-minded audience would also take to be, the most representative political organization, judicial body, and human rights organizations in the world today. Now, you say, or I gather from what you say, that if one of these rights were implemented, the right of return, it would compromise what Israel takes to be its right. But the international community doesn't agree on that. You can't both claim to adhere to the rule of law and then tell the Palestinians that they are somehow obliged to renounce a basic right of their own because you don't like it. You just don't have the right to do that. What you do have the right, in my opinion, to do, what you do have the right to do is to make Palestinians an offer for a settlement of the conflict such that they say, rather than exercise my right of return, I will choose your settlement offer instead. Obviously, a right means you don't have to exercise it if you choose not to exercise it. I often give the example, so you'll forgive me if you've heard me on YouTube, that I'm not comparing suffering. Believe me, I am sober enough to know magnitudes of suffering. I'm simply trying to demonstrate a principle. I was denied tenure at DePaul. The grounds, in the opinion of many, including my lawyer's opinion, the grounds were transparently false. The university itself acknowledged that I was an outstanding professor and a prodigious scholar. So how could you deny me tenure? My lawyer says, if you go to court, you'll win, you'll get back your right to return to DePaul. But she says to me, it's going to take a very long time. 10-year cases, if they're argued in court, they take six years. And she says, you really want to devote the next 6 years of your life to reliving the nightmare at the pool. And I said, well, not really, because I have bigger goals in life. I don't really care about academic freedom because I never believed it existed in the first place. So she says, okay, if we're agreed on that, then we shoot for a settlement with the pool. And the settlement has to have two components. One, there has to be an acknowledgement by the pool that had libeled me during that last year. And indeed, they did at the end acknowledge I was an excellent professor, teacher, and a prodigious scholar. And then there had to be a financial component to the settlement. We argued, we negotiated, we debated, we fought. It was ugly, mostly. In the end, there was a settlement, and I chose the settlement, and I didn't go back to the pool. Does that mean I didn't have a right to return? Oh, no. I certainly did have a right. But if you don't want me to return, and the pool sure as heck did not want me to return, you have to offer a reasonable settlement. And I don't think, in principle, the settlement is different with the Palestinians. Number one, Israel has to acknowledge the colossal injustice it inflicted on the Palestinians in 1948. They have to acknowledge that. The official position of Israel is, we will not accept any moral, historical, legal responsibility for what happened to the refugees. Well, that's a non-starter. If the poll said to me, we're not going to issue a statement, I would say, then we're going to court, and I'm coming back. Israel cannot begin by saying, we don't accept any responsibility for anything. That's a non-starter. And then there has to be some sort of financial offer. Now, does that mean the Palestinians will accept it? I don't know. I can't tell you that. What I can tell you is, I'm no expert on Palestinians, but I spend quite a lot of time there. I have a lot of very close friends. One in particular, Musa Abu Heshesh, from Fawar camp outside Hebron. And he tells me, frankly, he says, Norman, I'm very conservative on this right of return. And he takes me to the place where he and his family grew up, a tiny little hovel in Fawar camp, one room, very large family. And he says, I'm not going to give up that right so easily. So I said, okay, then what do you want? And he says, let them make us an offer. Let me see the offer. I think most Palestinians are reasonable. There are ways to resolve the conflict. The problem is not insurmountable obstacles. And the problem is not that the Palestinians are unreasonable. The problem is Israel wants everything. Israel doesn't want to acknowledge, accept the most elementary, basic principles of international law. The Palestinians renounced their claim to 78% of Palestine, and what did Israel do? It comes along and decides we're going to build a wall, and we're going to keep another 12% of the West Bank. And we're going to keep the best water resources in the West Bank. And we're going to keep the most productive agricultural lands in the West Bank. And we're going to build this wall so it circles the aerial settlement in the north and cuts the northern sector in half. Then it's going to build this wall to encircle Male Adonim in the center and cut the middle in half. Cut the bisect the West Bank in the middle. And then, after chopping it up, reducing it to fragments, stealing everything worth settling, they say, that's our offer. And that's the problem. Be reasonable. Acknowledge the wrong that was inflicted. I think the conflict can be settled. You have to be honest about that. It's not my opinion. It's not my opinion. You have to ask yourself one simple question. And you have to keep repeating the question over and over again. Why is it every year, the whole world on one side, Israel, the United States, Nauru, Palau, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia on the other. Why is that? Is the whole world anti-Semitic except for Nauru, Palau, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands? Are all 15 justices on the International Court of Justice anti-Semitic? All 15, including the one dissenter on the major vote, Bergenthal from the United States, a Holocaust survivor. All 15 said all the settlements are illegal under international law. Are all 15 judges anti-Semitic? Is Thomas Bergenthal, a Holocaust survivor, anti-Semitic? Is Rosalind Higgins, the British judge, who's Jewish by birth, is she anti-Semitic? Or is the problem that Israel, backed by the United States, they only want one thing from the Palestinians, only one thing from the Arab people. They want submission, submission, submission. And I don't think the Arabs or the Palestinians are obliged to submit to this state.
Professor Norman, first of all, I want to welcome you to our UBC Holy Land. And as professors and students, we are all chosen people. And I hope you can come on the graduation ceremony to see how our grandchildren graduate for global as global citizens to work for global justice and global peace. Because I think we have to trust the grandchildren. Now my question is related to, if you look at the list of all, if you read the biographies and autobiographies of all the prime ministers and the demography of Israel population, you find there is a significant number of them are Russians who either came in from Russia via the United States to Palestine and became Israelis, or they are Russian Palestinians, I would call them. And if you look at the demography, there were millions of Russians who came to settle. Some of them were not even Jews. I think they were caught as Nazis recently. I wonder what is your comment on looking at it from a nationalist line rather than looking at it as religious lines or Holocaust lines, and see what is the impact of the demography of the population on the Palestinians and on the Israeli population, because I think there is a lot of racism within the Israeli population as well, and also the dominant role the Russians are playing in it. And I also wonder if you consider Jews as a human shield of the American and British Empire, just as the Pakistanis are the Muslims in Pakistan are the human shield which were created by the British to fight the Hindus. Thank you.
I'm not sure how useful it is to trace back who came from where, and are they really Jewish, and whether they are converts, they were originally Palestinians, or they converted. I don't think it's useful to get involved in this kind of undertaking. because it just drags in all sorts of extraneous issues. This is not a clash of religions. It's not a clash of civilizations. There are basic political issues that are at stake, and in the most contemporary form, I'm not saying always, but in the most contemporary form, the problem is an occupation of another people's homeland, the systematic destruction of that homeland, the attempts to annex parts of that homeland, and the attempts to destroy what remains. And I think the most useful language is to use the language which the sponsors of this event use. Students for Palestinian Human Rights, or in the case of the United States, it's mostly what's called SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine. I think the emphasis should be on a language which is readily accessible to and understandable by the broad public, the language of justice, the language of human rights. There was a time when they had what were called Palestine Solidarity Committees. I was never particularly fond of that because it used to put the accent, the emphasis on the ethnic dimension of the conflict. It's about solidarity with Palestinians. No, I'm not in solidarity with Palestinians. And I'm not in solidarity with Muslims. And I'm not in solidarity with Jews, Israelis, or Americans. I have one solidarity, and that's the solidarity with basic principles of what's just and what's true. Who asked the question referred to grandchildren who are going to graduate, and I'm glad to see that among the younger generations they understand that kind of language and they understand what are the basic principles. The principles at stake are not ethnic ones, they're not religious ones. The basic principles that are at stake are the ones we all understand. The principles of what's true and what's just. The right of the Palestinians to elect the government that they want. Not the government that Condoleezza Rice wants, or Mr. Bush wants, or what the Europeans want. I don't know why the Europeans should be deciding. They elected Berlusconi, Sarkozy, and these are freaks. And this Blair, who always had this crazed look in his eyes. He made any mullah look secular by comparison. Who are they to tell the Palestinians who to elect? Can anyone name one Israeli prime minister who wasn't a terrorist? But they're allowed to elect whoever they want, but the Palestinians aren't allowed to elect Hamas. These are basic human rights. Because the Palestinians elected Hamas, the world has the right to starve them to death, to slap these economic sanctions on them. Those are the questions we have to ask, to keep it strictly and narrowly through the issues of human rights and justice.
Aside from the AIPAC lobby group, What other reasons are there for the U.S. government's unshakable support of Israel, and why does the AIPAC lobby group have so much influence compared to other lobby groups?
Well, I think there is a certain amount of distortion about AIPAC because there is a large, not entire, but there's a large overlap of interests and convergence of interests between the U.S. and Israel. So let's take Israel's last two undertakings. When it went into Lebanon in 2006, the Bush-Cheney administration, or Cheney-Bush administration, or Cheney administration, because Bush was with the king of Jordan in their bedroom playing with PlayStation 3, and it was really Cheney. Both of them wanted to knock out Hezbollah because they thought it would be a way of weakening Iran. That was a convergent interest of the U.S. and Israel. And the same thing with Hamas. It's the view of the Americans and many policymakers that Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, they form one axis, and one way to weaken Iran is to weaken its, as they call it, proxies. I don't agree with that description, but we'll leave that aside. So there's a convergence of interest. Now, there are places where there is a divergence of interests. I don't think the U.S. government has any stake in the settlements in the occupied territories. I don't think the U.S. government has any stake in the colonization of the occupied territories. And I think the U.S. government would be very happy if tomorrow an Israeli government were to say, we're packing up and leaving. And so there, I think the rational conclusion on the local issue of Israel-Palestine, the rational conclusion is it's the lobby that's shaping U.S. policy. But on the bigger regional issues, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, to a lesser extent, it's not the lobby. It's American interests. It's very foolish to think the lobby decides whether the U.S. is going to war with Iraq. Everybody agrees. The main architects of the war in Iraq were Cheney and Rumsfeld. No dispute about that. Cheney and Rumsfeld, they're not Jewish. Cheney and Rumsfeld do not care about Israel. Cheney and Rumsfeld do not care about Jews. They do not care about the Holocaust. They care about American national interests as they understand it. So some people say, but wait, wasn't it those Jewish neoconservatives like Wolfowitz, Fife, Wurmser, and all the rest, they tricked Cheney and Rumsfeld. They duped them. Well, there are many things to say about Mr. Cheney. You want to say he's a murderer? I'll go there with you on that one. You want to say he's a thug, a hoodlum, a moral monster? No dispute from me here. You want to say he's not the kind of kid, the kind of guy you would want to babysit your children? You want to say that you wouldn't want to be found in a dark alley with him? I'll go with you there. But stupid? Naive? No. He's a very smart man, for better or for worse, a very shrewd guy. You don't trick Mr. Cheney into going to war with Iraq to serve Israeli interests. That's simply not credible.
Dr. Finkelstein, thank you very much for coming. I'm pleased to be the second time in your audience, and every time is much better. You mentioned about the two-state solution being perhaps the most viable one, given that it's supported by so many international organizations and human rights groups. 2 points. One, May 11, 1949, Israel conceded the right of return and conceded the right of compensation to all Palestinians. Not many people mention this. It did so in United General Assembly Resolution 273, by which it was granted provisional status as a world body member, and then part of 273 was the inclusion of Resolution 194. So the whole question of whether Palestinians should or should not come back has been conceded. Now, to the point where, let's say, well, I may not exercise my right, do you think it's possible for Palestinians and Israelis, and I use the term Israeli loosely because they don't call themselves that, to live together and respect each other's right to exist? Now, in 2005, Israel left the Gaza Strip, and now look what happened. Israel will never allow Palestine to exist as an independent entity. So I have to question whether a two-state solution is really a viable option at all, and that a single binational state, however it is arrived at, is the only intelligent, logical solution, because without that, you have simply an unstable, semi-completed state. And bearing in mind that in the West Bank, there has been a change of type of Jews that had been living there. In the 1990s, the political Jews who came there in the name of Zionism left because they weren't satisfied. And they were replaced by radical, psychotic Slavs who came bringing the wrath of whatever God they believe in to Palestine. These Jews, as Shimon Peres says, might cause a civil war if they were asked to leave. Now, given the fact that most hardcore Zionists don't allow Palestine, much less Palestinians, the right to exist, how could you possibly expect that a two-state solution would be viable over any extended period of time?
Okay. Two comments, one a historical one and one a simple question of logic. Let's start with the historical one. In history, you should be very careful about using the word never. Things which seem impossible, strangely enough, they actually happen. I'm not so older than most people in the room, but not all. Relatively within my time, relatively speaking, the main, if not the main problem among African Americans in the United States was lynchings. After World War II, African Americans come back from fighting, and like after World War I, when they come back from fighting, they're seen to be too uppity. And so in 1947, 48, there are large numbers of lynchings in the American South. Very ugly scenes. Many people don't know what a lynching looked like in the United States. It was not some isolated tree in the dark of the night. Lynchings in the United States were big picnic events for the local town. Schools would be let out early. Workers were let out early. Mothers packed picnic baskets. They all went to the lynching site. After it was over, began the auctioning of body parts. Somebody wants the heart, the liver. They would pose with a body part. It would then be used as a postcard. That's what my country, tis of thee, looked like. Paul Robeson, some of you may know, probably few, his main struggle was trying to get President Truman in 1948 to pass an anti-lynching bill. He refused Truman for fear of losing the support of the South, which was mostly Democratic. at the time, the Dixiecrats, they were called. The other day, my brother gave me this CD of an old TV program which I liked to watch. It was called Ironsides with Raymond Burr. Ironside. Who knows it? Ironside. Oh, not bad. Raise your hand up high. Okay. Ironside comes out in the mid-1960s. The turbulent 1960s, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and it was considered a little bit cutting edge, a progressive program. Ironside has three assistants, a woman, a blonde bombshell, a fellow, he looked like straight out of one of Hitler's Superman camps, and lo and behold, an African-American. The woman, the white woman, and the white fellow, they would strategize with Raymond Burr, Ironside. I should say he's a detective, a police officer. They would strategize with him, but of course Raymond Burr was the smart one. They were just learning. The black fellow, what does he get to do? He gets to, Raymond Burr is paralyzed. That's why it's called Ironsides. He was shot in the spine. He's paralyzed. What does the black fellow get to do? He gets to wheel around Raymond Burr. That's right. That's his job. He gets to wheel him around. Remember, this is a progressive program. And when they're strategizing, he's in the back room playing pool. His only other job is, when Raymond Burr gets up in the middle of the night, he blows his whistle, and the black fellow has to come running out in his bathrobe. Okay? That's a progressive film in the 60s. TV show, it was a series. I start watching it, because I like murder mysteries. I'm watching, I'm thinking to myself, well, good gosh, we've gone quite a distance. The guy who's wheeling around Raymond Burr and running at his beck and call, he's now in the White House. So, never say never. We're talking about within the span of my life, how dramatically the American scene changed. Same thing, Europe. I mean, history of Europe for 300 years was just wars. Now, a war between France and Germany. Is it even thinkable? Is it even conceivable? But there was a time when if you talked about peace between France and Germany, people would say, never. Impossible. So we should always be cautious about that. The second point is, there's obviously a non sequitur in your argument. It makes logically it makes no sense. If you say that you can't imagine them living apart but together, then how could you then conclude it's more likely they'll be able to live together in peace? It's as if to say a husband and wife who want to kill each other, there is less possibility of them living in separate dwellings than living under one roof. Does that make any logical sense? It's a complete non sequitur. The problem is, and if I'm offending anyone, I don't intend to. I want to end the conflict. A lot of people are bored with the two-state settlement. It's been 30 years. They're tired. They want something novel, something original, something creative. They conjure up all of these formulas. It's a kind of Starbucks chatter. Because it's so difficult. People don't understand, I think. It's so difficult to change international opinion. It's such a huge victory that the Palestinians can now claim the International Court of Justice as supporting their aims. They can claim the entire international community as supporting their claims. They now have their Balfour Declaration. They now have their partition resolution. They now have their certificates of legitimacy. And when they've had all these great victories, suddenly people come along and say, ah, it's all passé. Let's move on to something else. It's not serious. It's not serious, and that's why we always lose. Instead of trying to isolate Israel and say you are the only obstacle to a negotiated settlement, now people want to come along and say, we don't want that settlement either. That's exactly what Israel wants to hear. So now they can tell the world, it's not just us, it's them too, who don't want to settle the conflict. Remember, Israel tried to destroy the PLO, not when it called for one secular state, but when it went along with the international community. They tried to destroy Hamas, not when it was calling for one Islamic state in Palestine, but when it was coming out in favor of two states. What Israel dreads is a reasonable Palestinian interlocutor for peace. That's what it opposes. And that's when it does its best to defeat those peace offensives.
Okay. I'm afraid we just have time for one more question, so our last question will come from the woman on the side.
Thank you very much for your talk. Just back to the topic of the U.S. backing of Israel, and I have a few questions or a couple points on that. Would you say that, you know, when you talk about Israel as being a lunatic state, that the U.S. is sort of equally, if more, not more lunatic in its treatment of Palestine and its backing of Israel? And also you talked about that the U.S. doesn't have a vested interest in, it doesn't have a reason to oppose the two-state solution. So would opposing the two-state solution, would that weaken the U.S.'s power within Israel, the power sort of center within the Middle East? What would the U.S. motivation be? Because without the U.S., Israel doesn't have that power. So without the U.S., what would the U.S. need in terms of motivation to actually support the two-state solution? And do you think that there's hope with Barack Obama? I heard an interview recently on CBC, and he was also interviewed by Amy Goodman and Democracy Now. I can't remember his name, but he's a Palestinian-American. Yeah, and he thought that there was hope with Barack Obama that there would be a change in tone in terms of the very pro-Israel stance that Congress has taken. Do you see a hope with Obama? What will it take for the U.S. to back off and to actually endorse this?
Well, you know, there are two possibilities, obviously. One possibility is that people organize sufficiently that they can put pressure on their government to change its position. And that means what you have to do in any situation to try to get the government to do what it doesn't want to do. In this case, it means countering the lobby. I think there are very real prospects here. If we get our act together, we can become a formidable force to change policy, because I think support for Israel has died. I mean, you see it everywhere I go. You can check YouTube. I always begin by saying, if you have dissent, you go first. And everywhere I go, the other side doesn't dare go to the microphone. Here you have one gentleman who I respect for showing that kind of courage. They don't go because they know they've lost on the facts. They have no leg to stand on. And that should tell us something. If they're afraid to appear, afraid to question, afraid to show their face, it means that's their weakness. It's their vulnerability. And that's where we should work. So that's one possibility. And the other possibility is that ruling elites reach the conclusion that Israel is just becoming a liability. At least some of its policies are becoming a liability, and it's time to force Israel to withdraw. You can't say with certainty that won't happen. It's possible that, you can't say it with certainty, it's possible that Barack Obama or his administration will reach the conclusion that maybe putting more pressure on Israel would serve the U.S. national interest, that Israel's conduct has simply gotten out of hand. Now, I agree, let's be clear. As an American, as horrific as Israel's crimes are, they pale in comparison to what the U.S. does on each hour of each day in the world. And we should maintain proportions. If I say Israel has become a lunatic state, it's because aspects of it are simply hard to comprehend. So, for example, you go into a defenseless place, you flatten it. About 80% of the casualties, 80% is the current estimate, 85, are civilians. One third are children. Any other society, whatever the goal was, however noble the goal was, for argument's sake, when you see pictures like that, figures like that, statistics like that, you're a little bit embarrassed. But the opinion polls and all the available information shows, as Gideon Levy said in the comments I quoted, he says, the public's shocking indifference to these figures is incomprehensible. You've incinerated 400 children, and they go gloating about their great military victory. If the killing ratio is 100-1, a rational person knows this is not a display of military prowess. This is a slaughter. It's shooting fish in a barrel. And yet they gloat. Now there's something positively bizarre about that. He calls it incomprehensible. And as the massacre unfolded, Avi Shlaim, the Israeli-born historian Oxford, he called the war insane. Another person called it mad. There was just a sheer lunacy about it. There was even a lunacy about the conclusion. You think you restored the Arab world's fear of your military when you committed that massacre in Gaza? You think you've now instilled fear of your soldiers? If a mafia don goes into a schoolyard and breaks the bones of 5-year-olds, it's not like you have displayed your military prowess. You have displayed the fact that you are a sadistic lunatic. And I don't understand how they can even be gloating. 1/3 children, and you're gloating about your military prowess? I have no great illusions about the American people. But I cannot imagine if they saw those figures, they would be proud. There's just something seriously awry in that place. The first week of that massacre, they were reporting that Israel didn't want to put all of its troops into Gaza because it was preparing for a war against Iran. What is this place? War after war after war after war. Something has gone seriously awry. And I think people understand that now. I don't think Israel's prospects in the medium term are very good. I think it will probably end up being destroyed. I do. And I am not gleeful about that. You know, if you want to infer that from me, you're way off the beam. I don't see any virtue or any value in any country, any society being destroyed. I do think it needs to suffer a few real military defeats to knock some sense into it. You know, it's a horrible thing to have to say, but the best thing that ever happened to Germany was Nazism. It was the worst thing that ever happened to its victims. But it was the best thing that happened to Germany, because it was a very deeply racist and militaristic state. And after the defeat it suffered in World War II, that defeat at a horrific price for its victims, but that defeat broke the back of German racism and German militarism. And now it's clear that the most humane population in Europe, especially the young people, is clearly the Germans. They're the most morally serious, the most intelligent. They benefited from the defeat. And I think Israel needs to suffer some defeats, like Germany, in order to get its sense knocked into it. The problem is, as people often say, Israel can only afford to lose one war. And I think it's headed in a terrible direction. And I wish for them, you know, leaving aside the victims, like the victims of Nazism, leaving aside the victims for their own sake, I wish they would wake up and see they've now become the most hated country on earth, and unfortunately, deservedly so. And for their sake, I hope they wake up.
Thank you so much, Dr. Finkelstein.